power. The fleet was required to traverse about one-third of the Olassa system to close on the probe. In the meantime, the scout ship came abreast of the nearest Olassa warship. Trium linked to the ship's comm systems, and Bethley, utilizing Julian's Olassa lexicon and ultrasonic frequencies, sent, "We request the Scarlet Mandator." "It's one of the progenitor's seedling ships," the tasker said, who managed the ship's comms, the bloom turning toward the executor. "It's requesting to speak with Scarlet Mandator." "Tasker, respond to its query," the executor ordered. "How?" the tasker asked. "The aliens won't comprehend our coordinate system." "It was said that Julian used images to first converse with Scarlet Mandator. Monitor, try sending an image to the seedling ship," the executor ordered. The monitor thought, wondering how to communicate the information to the aliens. Staring at the navigation board, the monitor had an epiphany. First, the monitor annotated a display of the worlds of lights with a small circle and placed next to it the shape of the seedling ship. Then a small plus sign located the Scarlet Mandator's ship position. Finally, a line connected the two positions. "You believe the aliens will understand that?" the executor said, the bloom hovering over the monitor's position. "Any navigator would understand this, executor," the monitor replied. "And the progenitors who travel between the lights of the dark will certainly understand it." "Then send it," the executor replied. The monitor's bloom swung toward the tasker seeking help, and the tasker captured the image on the monitor's board and sent it to the seedling ship. "A progenitor, who goes by the name Bethley, offered thanks to those aboard this ship," the comm tasker said. "The seedling vessel has left," the monitor noted, the pad of a stalk pointing to the line on the panel. A bright dot traced its path, and the monitor's stalks proudly straightened. "We have Scarlet Mandator's location, Dasida. The Mandator is indeed aboard a ship. Unfortunately, you're approaching the Mandator's position, and so is the probe," Killian sent. "We have the Mandator's location, Killian," Alex replied. "Nice work, the three of you. Continue with your assignment, Killian." 2 days later, the Vivian's mirror sidled next to Scarlet Mandator's ship. "Scarlet Mandator welcomes your return," Melon Tasker sent over the comm. "We query if you're the seedling vessel that was originally entwined with this ship." "The alien, Bethley, assures you, Scarlet Mandator, that this is so," Melon Tasker announced, relaying the response. "Bethley, Julian will translate for me, and you will relay to Scarlet Mandator," Alex sent.
"Affirmative, Dasida," Bethley sent.
"Julian, the Mandator must head inward immediately," Alex sent. "Our common enemy has left a dangerous piece of equipment orbiting the worlds of light, and we must destroy it." Julian's first thought was this was Cordelia's fort, creating images that portrayed complicated statements. He decided to rely on simplistic images that built on one another. "By some means, Scarlet Mandator, we're receiving images on the navigation board," Golden Executor said, indicating Teal Monitor's panel. "Aliens," the Executor added. Scarlet Mandator's stalks moved to place the bloom over the panel. A representation of the worlds of light had appeared first. A dot indicated what the Mandator considered the Mandator's ship's position. The dot grew to encompass the panel and morphed into an image of a scarlet bloom, then shrank again to the dot. Then the dot moved toward the homeworld. Finally, as the dot cleared the second outermost planet's orbit, a massive bright light blanked much of the edge of the display. "Turn the ship inward now," Scarlet Mandator ordered. "The progenitors are warning us." Golden Executor ordered the course change, without understanding the reason, but it was known that the Mandator knew the aliens best. "More images, Mandator," Teal Monitor announced. The blooms of both the Mandator and Executor bent over the panel to watch.
The image of the worlds of light appeared again. A tiny dot came from outside the system and took up an orbit around the outermost planet. The dot grew to display a small round object, and the blooms of the Mandator and Executor swung toward each other. Concentric waves emanated from the object, pulsing in all directions. "The device from beyond is communicating," Teal Monitor said, which answered the senior Olasa's questions. Julian had the probe's image slide off to the left, and he focused on the representation of the communication waves. Extending them on past stars for enough time to represent a long distance. Then from the right entered the sphere's image where the transmission ended. "Clever, Julian," Killian commented. Bethley continued to repeat Julian's visual messages. When the first ship had sent the image from the navigation board via the comm, Bethley was able to trace the path and reverse it to display Julian's imagery for Scarlet Mandator. On the Olasa's bridge, the four entities who were watching the image display froze. Stalks and fronds trembled. "The great orb came to the worlds of light, following the transmission of that object," Scarlet Mandator said, understanding dawning. "Golden Executor, warn all ships. They are to proceed immediately away from the progenitor ships. Tell them that the Omnians have found a dangerous device belonging to the Great Orb." The Executor complied with the orders and asked, "What will the aliens do with the device?" "Recall the images," the Mandator said. "The bright light at the far world's orbit," the Executor surmised. "Yes," Scarlet Mandator answered simply. "Was the representation inaccurate? The light covered a great amount of distance," Golden Executor asked. "Or is the Great Orb's device that dangerous?" the Mandator posited. Several days later, and by the Omnian fleet's ship time, it was the middle of the night. Leaders and senior officers were asleep, and junior officers manned the bridges of the tridents. "Julian, the Olasa ships are clear of the danger zone, and the probe is entering a safe area for detonation," Z sent. "Should we wait for Alex to rise and give the order?" "The window of opportunity will close in 4 hours when the probe enters that massive asteroid section," Julian replied. "Launch the Banisher, Z. I will inform the squadron's bridge officers." It was unnecessary to mention communicating to the scout ship SAIDs. As had become common, they were maintaining constant links with Julian, Z, and Miranda. Z checked the status of the bay, ensuring there were no humans present. With the bay clear, he signaled its depressurization, after which he opened the doors. As soon as there was clearance, Z selected one of the banishers and activated its program. Guiding the device out of the bay, Z pointed it toward the probe, and transferred the device's location coordinates and its trajectory path to the Banisher's controller. Programmed and armed, the Banisher accelerated toward its target. As the Omnian tool had operated at the Oistus and Hellebore systems, the Banisher slowed when it approached the probe and gingerly gripped the alien device with its clamshell claws. Instantly, the probe detonated, blanking the Omnian vid telemetry. "The Nuall toys just don't like being handled," Miranda sent. "Poor dears, something must be amiss in their upbringing." "It does make you wonder what we'll discover when we come face to face with the Nuall," Killian sent. "I, for one, have spent too much time and crystal energy assimilating the collected data on the Nuall and trying to envision them," Z said. "It is a subject that Cordelia and I have discussed interminably, and we are no closer to a conclusion than when we first encountered the Libran sphere," Julian said. "Julian and Z, is it possible that the problem is that the two of you are trying to resolve your data into an image of a single species, when there might be more than one operating in cooperation?" Miranda asked. "Considered frequently," Z answered. "Considered interminably," Julian replied. Well, then it looks like we shall have to capture this second sphere so that we can knock on a hatch and ask for a vid, Miranda quipped. The Sades shared their creative versions of laughter with Miranda.
After that suggestion, I believe I will borrow a concept from Alex, Z sent.
Which is, Miranda inquired.
That females should be given the privilege of proceeding first, Z replied, which resulted in a second round of laughter.
You, my dear, may be cut off from my charms if you're not careful, Miranda replied.
The only one laughing in response to Miranda's retort was Z, but then he was the only one allowed.
What now, Julian? Killian asked.
I'm directing the fleet toward the sphere's position where it picked up its last bullet ship after the conflict. Within several hours, Alex will awake and join us, and then we can discuss how we wish to proceed. With many options open to us, it might be difficult to identify which probe signal the sphere focused on.
There will be celestial drift in its many forms, Z reminded Julian.
We have an approximate time displacement. We will need our combined processing power to compute the drifts and accurately correct the vector, or we'll be chasing signals without results, Julian advised.
Scarlet Mandator and Golden Executor had received the data on the explosion. The detonation's magnitude had the petals on both blooms curling under in trepidation.
The device was so small as not to be found during the annuals that it sat out there, the executor said. Yet its destruction engulfed more space than one could believe.
Thanks should be given to you, Scarlet Mandator, when you withheld your pad from the seedling vessel, Teal Monitor said.
The praise belongs to the Omnians, Scarlet Mandator said.
They retrieved their seedling ship and worked to communicate with us, learning of the existence of the Great Orb's passing.
I wonder at the reason for their return. Was it to benefit them in their pursuit of the Predator, or did they wish to rid us of the Orb's device? We might never know their motivation.
The Progenitor's methods indicate that they're experienced with these dangerous devices, Teal Monitor reasoned.
When blooms of the Mandator and Executor swiveled toward the Monitor, the Olasa added,
the aliens cleared a wide swath of dark around the tiny device, much more space than one would consider reasonable. They must know of these devices' destructive capabilities when they're approached.
Teal Monitor, where are the Omnians headed? Scarlet Mandator asked.
Not on any vector that will intersect one of our worlds of light, Mandator, the Monitor replied.
I will be retiring to the recovery room, the Mandator said.
There will be time later, much later, to attempt to identify the Progenitor's purpose.
Alex woke in the morning following the probe's destruction. After a meal, Alex, the senior officers, and the Sades stood on the bridge to review events.
"Congratulations, Julian, on a successful execution of the probe," Alex said, ensuring that the bridge officers heard that he had no problem with Julian's decision to proceed, while the leaders and senior officers slept.
"Yes, well, I know how much humans need their beauty sleep, so I was loath to interrupt yours," Julian replied with a sly smile.
He was immediately bombarded by imagery, portraying him in a variety of negative ways, by every human on the bridge, especially from the women, Renee, Tatia, Reiko, and Svetlana.
"Was it something I said?" Julian asked innocently, and Alex, laughing, slapped him on the back.
"So where are we headed, Julian?" Alex asked.
"To the starting point, Alex, where we believe the sphere was before it took up the vector that sent it chasing the next probe's signal."
Tatia stared at Julian, Z, and then Miranda. She asked,
"How in the stars are you going to determine the start point and the vector, with all the factors that complicate those determinations after the decades that have passed?"
"With great difficulty, Admiral," Z replied.
"The Sades have been at work on the subject since we destroyed the probe, Admiral," Julian added. "Regrettably, we're yet to finish our calculations."
"The Sades have been working through the night and haven't come to a conclusion. How is that possible?" Reiko asked. The data we received from the Olasa didn't have the specificity of our telemetry parameters, Commodore, Z replied. In addition, we've been challenged by multiple suggestions, which halted the calculations and required us to rerun them once each new idea was researched, Julian explained. In the past hour, no more suggestions have been made, so we believe we're close to a final estimation, Z added.
What is the expected accuracy? Alex asked.
With regret, Alex, Z replied. We calculate 36.7% for the starting point and 22.4% for the correct vector.
Wow, Svetlana said, eyeing the sades.
Unfortunately, too true, dear, Miranda said.
On another subject, how many probe signals have you detected? Alex asked, looking from sade to sade.
More than you would believe, dear man, now that we know what we're seeking, Miranda said.
Which leaves us considering what? Signal strength? Reiko asked.
That was our primary assumption, Commodore, Julian replied, nodding to Reiko.
We've ranked the probes by that parameter, he added, sharing a link to the file with every human.
You're kidding, Julian, Reiko said, when she reviewed her copy, amazed at the number of entries.
The Nual appear to have been at work, investigating this part of the galaxy long before humans arrived here, Julian said.
It makes one reconsider the viewpoint of our enemy, who undoubtedly see us as interlopers, Z commented.
They could have asked us nicely to leave, Miranda replied tartly.
Not that we would have obliged them, but it would have been polite of them to have made the effort.
If I understand the plan, it's to set up on the spot where we estimate the sphere was last stationary. Estimate the vector it took, factoring in drift we don't have accurate data on. Then we check the strength of probe signals and hope one of the stronger ones is close to our intended trajectory.
Is that about right? Tatia asked, incredulous at the proposal's feebleness.
Precisely, Admiral, Julian replied with a charming smile. At least in regard to your accurate description of our somewhat feeble plan.
That comment ended the morning's discussion. Alex and his officers had left the fleet's sailing in the hands of the Sades until Alex received a short comm from Julian in the evening, which said, "We're here, Alex." Alex left his desk, kissed Renee quickly, and strode to the bridge. He was joined by the senior officers and the Sades.
"What do our options look like?" Alex asked.
Julian triggered the holovid and displayed a representation of their ship's position, a line detailing the proposed vector and a set of tiny lights in the distance, which varied in brilliance.
"Those are the probes out there and their relative strength?" Reiko asked.
"Precisely, Commodore," Julian replied.
"None appear to line up with the calculated trajectory," Svetlana observed, staring closely at the holovid's display.
"Also true, Captain," Julian replied.
"Perhaps the sphere is choosing a new destination, not on the strength of the signal, but by what information a probe is broadcasting," Alex surmised.
"That would be helpful if we could decode the broadcast and understand the language," Tatia grumped.
Alex was undeterred and stood staring at the holovid.
"What's the plan, then?" Reiko asked. "Which probe signal do we chase?"
The Sades glanced at one another.
"Forgive them, Commodore," Miranda groused. "They don't wish to admit that they have no suggestion, and are hoping our dear leader has some sort of intuition as to which way we should go."
"Do you, Alex?" Tatia asked.
"Not a clue," Alex replied.
"Julian, display the map cones that correspond to every scenario that you ran. Include any proposal that received a probability above 10%, Alex requested. The Sades pulled up their various analyses and mapped them into the display. Julian color-coded them as Alex preferred. The cones were semi-transparent, which allowed colors to combine in an additive process.
"That's bewildering," Reiko commented, but she said no more when Tatia signaled her for quiet. Alex drew close to the display and enlarged it, focusing on the point of the cones, which lay at the ship's present position. "I like this trajectory," he said, pointing to an extremely thin segment that was nearly as black as the dark of space.
"The overlap of our scenario's probabilities," Z said. "A mathematician's delight."
Julian eliminated the cones and added a dotted line that represented the overlap of their many calculations. It became their tentative new vector. In the far distance lay a probe with moderate signal strength.
"Who would have thought of that?" Reiko whispered in a hush.
"Only a human," Julian replied, grinning at his friend.
"The Omnian ships are moving," Teal Monitor reported to Golden Executor, who in turn hailed the Mandator to come to bridge control.
Scarlet Mandator arrived on the bridge and immediately entered a code into the navigation panel. A line popped up in the display. It didn't quite match the trajectory of the Omnian ship.
"What is the plot you added, Mandator?" the Executor asked.
"It's the vector that the Great Orb used when it left the Worlds of Light."
"The aliens are off target. Should they be warned?" the Executor asked.
"Are the Worlds of Light fixed? Do the lights beyond not subtly shift their positions over the course of time? If any species understands this, the Omnians surely do," the Mandator explained.
"What does the action of the progenitors mean, Mandator?" Melantasker asked.
"The Omnians came to the Worlds of Light to eliminate the device left behind by the Great Orb. That task is complete. Now they go to find the Great Orb itself and destroy it."
"Courageous animals," the Mandator said.
"And others," adding absently and thinking of Julian.
Chapter 17 The Hunt
Tatia ordered the fleet to transit to a destination millions of kilometers outside their target system, and she sent the scout ships forward to look for evidence of the Nual vessel.
"The sphere has been here," Lin reported from his scout ship. "Telemetry indicates a water planet with incongruent areas of missing greenery and what could be thought of as significant areas of strip mining, but there are no indications of a civilization."
"The ashes would reveal that," Tatia commented to Alex.
"Your deduction was decisive, Alex," Z said. "As one who embraces the world of numbers and probabilities, I must appreciate your abstract reasoning."
Alex craned his neck to stare at the Sayd.
"I'm practicing," Z replied, his expression one of apology. "Miranda said I was to be more in touch with my emotional algorithms, elevating them in my hierarchy."
"That was creepy, Z," Reiko commented, and several individuals on the bridge nodded their agreement. Alex replied, "I deeply appreciate the sentiment, Z," which drew a smile from the Sayd before Alex added, "but your technique needs work. A lot of work." Z's frown was juxtaposed to the laughter around the bridge, but Alex brought everyone quickly back to business when he sent to the scout ships, "Locate the probe."
"We have Dasada," Trium replied.
Alex was linking to the controller for the data, but Julian anticipated his needs. "Captain Bilardo's trident, the Judgment, is closest, Alex."
Tatia had chosen to spread the Trident squadron wide, encompassing nearly a quarter of the outer planet's orbit. She didn't expect to catch the sphere in this first system, but she was being careful.
The Libran Nual sphere, which had devastated half of the Confederation's colonies, never stayed longer than 12 years in any one system. In some cases, the sphere moved on within 7 years. According to the Olasa data, the sphere had been gone for nearly 6 decades.
"Captain Bilardo, eliminate that probe," Tatia ordered.
"With pleasure," Lucia replied.
Lucia Bilardo signaled her controller to take the warship on a course that arced in system. Using the scout ship's data, Lucia directed the controller to focus on the probe's present position. The telemetry data revealed it would be a while before she could launch a banisher. At present, the probe was moving through a heavy asteroid field.
"I want a closer look at the planet that the Nual hit," Alex said, and Tatia ordered the remainder of the squadron to proceed in system. She left the scout ships on the system's periphery to facilitate an early warning. Several days later, the squadron surrounded the sphere's targeted world.
"Did you want to land, Alex?" Tatia asked, but he shook his head.
"No reason to, Tatia," Alex said.
"I wanted to get close enough to see if we could detect anything about the civilization that might have been lost, but as usual, there's nothing left to give us an indication of that."
"Alex, there is little evidence of a civilization," Julian said, attempting to mollify his friend.
"We can't identify any significant deposits of ash. It looks like the Nual might have taken an opportunity to collect resources from a planet inhabited only by non-sentient species."
"I don't understand why the Nual don't settle one of these planets. This one seems perfect," Riiko said.
"The Nual appear to harvest just enough resources to allow the planet to recover in decades or a century," Svetlana added.
"Perhaps what the Nual require isn't available to them out here, but only from their civilization," Z reasoned.
"So why come out here like a bunch of prospectors? Take what they need to keep going and move on to the next world," Riiko asked, continuing to press for an explanation that made sense to her.
"The spheres might be tools of colonization, but not in a manner that we would be comfortable understanding," Alex said. The bridge crew quieted, waiting. "What if the spheres are like farmers, tilling the land for future habitation? In some systems, like this one, they take what they need for resources to enable them to keep moving. Then in other systems, like the Confederation colonies, they clear the competing civilizations."
"This means the Nual are taking the long view, the same as they've done with their probes," Tatia said thoughtfully.
"That's more evidence of an extraordinarily extensive and ancient race."
"I'd agree," Alex replied.
Silence lay over the bridge. Hunting the second sphere had seemed like an exercise in the squadron's favor. They could easily remove an enemy vessel hampered by limited protection. Suddenly, that encounter appeared to be a minor event in what well could become their civilization's single focus: survival against a great and powerful enemy.
"Considering space is three-dimensional, one can only conclude that the Nual are expanding in every direction. It makes one reconsider the number of spheres and probes that they have launched," Z said.
"The longer this discussion continues, the scarier it gets," Renee said.
"I'd say let's pack our bags and move, but it would probably only delay the inevitable. Someday, somewhere, the Nual will come for our worlds."
"Well said," Alex replied. "Better we find out who and what we're dealing with now."
"In hindsight, the proposals to the other governments to lease our technology so that they might build tridents, fighters, and scout ships seems most timely," Svetlana commented.
"What now, Alex?" Tatia asked.
Alex looked at Julian, who said, "As expected, Alex, we have a significant number of choices."
Miranda commented, "It was our thought that the prime factor was probe strength, but our dear man has disabused us of that notion with his choice of a moderate strength signal, which against all probability turned out to be accurate.
Now we are left to do what my partner loves most."
"Guessing," Z said, as if he had a disgusting taste in his mouth. There were polite chuckles, but no one suggested an alternative.
"We can't afford to separate the squadron to chase the possibilities," Riiko insisted. She had her hands on her hips to accentuate her opinion.
"Wouldn't think of it, Commodore," Alex replied, chuckling. "Then narrowing the systems to our next target falls to the scout ships," Tatia stated. "Julian, have the Sades make their sixth best," Alex glanced over at Z as he finished, "guesses, then get them on their way. Commodore, move the squadron far outside this system in the direction we'll most likely be heading. I don't want to sit here," Tatia ordered. "Z, please transfer the squadron's destination coordinates to the scout ships that might return before we move again." This became the fleet's routine. Mind-numbing tedium was the order of the day, week after week. The scout ships would search until they found the next system where the Nual had visited. Communication would fly between the squadron and the scout ships, and the fleet would converge on the new location. Then the process would start over again. At one evening's meal, after the fleet had started the process again, having arrived at the most recently attacked system, which indicated evidence of a rudimentary civilization burned to ash, the conversation became despondent. "Another society that we were too late to save," Rieko lamented. "I understand that seeing these planets ravaged as they are is depressing," Renee said, sipping on the remains of her agar. "But I recommend a different view. We are expending weeks to locate the next system, and then using that same amount of time again to travel to it. But the Nual spent an average of 7 to 12 years in these systems. With every step, we're closing on our target. Eventually, we will find it. Focus on that." Alex stared at his partner as if she had sprouted a senior officer's cap on her head. When Renee glanced at him, he grinned, and she smiled in return.
"I want order on my ships," Admiral Tripping railed.
He was on the bridge of the N.T. Jeffrey Orlan, with Captain Jonathan Morney at his side, and Captains Alphonse Jagelski and Bart Philister on the comm.
"My officers are to discipline any conduct unbefitting new Terran naval service. Am I understood?"
When the captains signaled their affirmatives, Tripping continued his rant.
"There is to be zero tolerance for any infractions. I don't want to hear that a fight started but was quickly broken up without also hearing the individuals were charged and punished. Lock them up if you have to."
"Admiral, excuse me, these are Omnian-designed ships. They have no means of incarcerating crew," Jagelski said.
"Impossible," Tripping replied, his voice rising.
When Morney nodded his head in agreement with Jagelski, Tripping ground out,
"Are you telling me that the Omnians don't have fights?"
"It's their implants, Admiral," Jagelski shared. "I've spoken to Commodore Shimada and Captain Thompson several times on this subject. The implants allow them to share their thoughts quickly and simply. It makes it nearly impossible to lie or hide behind a false mask, as it were. The troubles between our crew members are created because individuals are hiding behind lies and sly actions meant to get the better of others. The problem is that when the true intent of their words or deeds are exposed, angry reactions develop and fights break out."
"What are you suggesting, Captain? That new Terrans should get these Meridian devices installed in their heads? Then we'd play nice with one another?"
"No, sir," Jagelski replied. He regretted trying to educate Tripping. It had failed so many times, and he wondered why he kept trying.
"Well, we need to find a way to lock up these regulation breakers, so they understand that there will be discipline on my ships," Tripping replied, moderating his voice, since he felt he'd made his point.
"We could always keelhaul them, sir," Philister suggested.
"Excellent suggestion, Captain. Implement that immediately," Tripping said, and ended the conference.
Immediately, Alphonse calmed Bart Philister.
"Well, Captain Philister, I'm ready to introduce your punishment of keel hauling, but I'm having some problems with the details. First, I don't have any rope to stretch around the midline circumference of my ship, And second, how do we keep the crew members alive after we throw them out of the airlock and drag them around the ship? Finally, it was my understanding that we were supposed to have some sort of growth on our hull, something about mollusks that were supposed to scrape the hide from those we're punishing. Where do we get those? Alphonse was trying hard to keep from laughing. He wanted to hear how his affable friend would reply.
"I thought surely that Admiral Tripping would help me with the details," Bart replied, trying desperately to contain the mirth that threatened to bubble out of him.
"Well, there's your first mistake, Bart. You know you're going to be in hot water with the Admiral when he finds out you were toying with him."
"Probably not," Bart replied, finally chuckling at the exchange.
"I'll tell him that I read the expression in an ancient naval manual, but I didn't know what it meant. Claiming ignorance allows our admiral the opportunity to lecture me, which does wonders for his ego."
"That's too true," Jagielski agreed. "About the admiral's point, are you having many problems on board your ship?"
"Nothing like those on Morny's, Alphonse," Bart replied. "The rumor mill has it that the chiefs aboard his ship have had to deal with an assortment of issues, including 3 knife fights, an attempted sexual assault, and an assortment of fist fights that involved 5 or more crew members, most of them over gambling arguments. How about you?"
"Nothing like that either. Some one-on-one scuffles that the chiefs or crew broke up, and some vocal arguments that involved name-calling.
What are you doing for punishment besides keel-hauling, Bart?"
"Basically, I keep my officers in line, and I let the chiefs handle the issues with the crew. If they write someone up, then they suggest the punishment length, which in most cases I've approved. Then the crew member spends time in some spare cabins that are aft of the ship near the drive engines. They're fairly utilitarian."
"How is their time spent?" Alphonse asked.
"They're told to stay in the cabin, and food and water are brought to them. They have no access to vids, and no one is allowed to talk to them. Isolation seems to do the job. It shows them that absolute boredom can be an ugly thing."
"I know we're getting closer to this sphere with every transit," Alphonse replied. "But I don't think any of us, by that I mean New Terrans, thought it would take this long to track it down. The Omnians are a patient lot. I wonder how they're passing the time."
At the time of Alphonse's musing, there was a raucous celebration among a fair bunch of the O.S. prosecutor's crew, who had won a round against the crew of the O.S. Liberator. There was nothing at stake but the pride of winning. After the squadron had completed its transit to a stationary point far outside the Olassa system, Tania could visualize the long and tedious effort that tracking the sphere would require. Immediately, she recruited Renee, who would understand her intentions.
"We need to start the games, Renee," Tatia had said that evening in Renee's cabin.
"The old games for implant training?" Renee asked.
"Yes, I'll devise a schedule that will maximize off-duty time for the crews while we wait for a scout ship to notify us of our next location. But I can't afford them to sit idle watching vids from your collection. Fabulous as they might be," Tatia said, quickly adding the last phrase. Renee chuckled. She knew Tatia wasn't a fan, and probably never would be. More than likely, the Admiral, in her off time, could be found participating in hand-to-hand combat exercises with the twins, which they hosted for the more aggressive crew members. Short of Etienne and Alain, there were few that could best her. Tatia often thought one or two of the larger, more agile New Terrans let her win, but the twins assured her that the crew members would consider it a coup if they could defeat the Admiral.
"Most of our crews haven't played the games since they were at the Naval Academy on Harrakhan, Tatia. It won't be like signaling an old algorithm to run."
"That's why I'm asking for your thoughts, Renee."
"Well, if we borrow from Alex's methods, he wouldn't try to jumpstart the process across the squadron. Instead, he'd do something like get a couple of small groups together and start the game. Once those crew members started having fun, it would spread quickly."
"What about the officers?" Tatia asked.
"Good point. Tatia, you should start a second game, exclusive to the officers, but make it ship against ship. When the crews on the other ships hear about the games being played on this ship, and that the officers are competing across ships, they'll want to do the same thing. Should we set up a reward or prize?
If I was thinking like Alex, I would say no, Tatia. Winners will have bragging rights. When do you intend to start the games?
Who, me? I'm the Admiral. I have to stay out of things like officer and crew competitions and that sort of rivalry.
Ah, now I understand why you wanted to chat.
I knew you would, Tatia replied, grinning, as she exited Renee's cabin. The games grew as Renee predicted. It wasn't long before Alex and the Sage thought it was full-scale war between ships. Teams formed ad hoc during duty time in preparation for the next contest. The teams had to be equal in number, and the Sages were kept busy setting up the games and monitoring them. Franz and his commanding officers constituted a sixth Omnian officer group that competed against the other ships, and his pilots formed their own groups and competed against one another. As the squadron's commodore, Reiko was embarrassed to admit that her team frequently lost, and she was often the weak link. Initially, she had been trained to use the implants with the aid of the games, but her time at Harrigan's Naval Academy had been demanding, and soon after graduation, she was tasked to be the captain of the Harrigan's first sting ship, the Tanaka. She did note that by participating in these games, she learned more about her implant's capabilities than she had in many years. The twins, Etienne and Alain, did their part to relieve the boredom. Their demonstrations, which usually consisted of the twins sharpening their escort skills, often drew admirers from the crew, and they had expanded their efforts to include the onlookers. Now the twins took advantage of the time the fleet sat stationary, waiting for a report, to jump from ship to ship to put on their demonstrations and start small classes. Their training techniques caught on, and soon the twins were kept extraordinarily busy. Alex ordered vidcams mounted in all of the Omnian ship's training areas. Julian programmed them so that only Etienne or Alain could activate them. It allowed the twins to monitor the classes across the Omnian ships and offer real-time critiques.
Chapter 18 Homeworlds 2 The ratification of the Omnian Agreement was a fait accompli for Presidents Lachaud and Grumley. Their governments, having only the one system, had allowed each populace to witness the immense explosion of the relatively diminutive probe. Previous to these events, the fight against the Libran sphere, which was viewed by many new Terrans at the time, courtesy of Julian's vids, was more than two decades ago. There was little to suggest that there was anything more to fear from whoever had created the mysterious sphere. However, the announcement that the Nual had been monitoring systems throughout the galaxy, including theirs, and the detonation of the probes changed all that for New Terra and Harrigan. In a flood of concern for their populace's safety, the agreements were ratified by New Terra and Harrigan and sent to Captain Cordelia, who had been authorized by Alex to accept them. Her approval, once received by the respective presidents, provided the means to unlock the data vaults that Therese and Maria had carried with them from Omnia. While Alex and the fleet chased the second sphere, Harrigan and New Terra began construction of the enclosed bays they would need to spray the faux shells on the manufactured frames and bulkheads of their first tridents. Neither government saw a need to hurry and build scout ships. The tiny ships required SAID crews, and the Harrigans and New Terrans thought the long-range searches were best left to the Omnians, who had a knack for it. On the other hand, it wasn't smooth sailing for Gino with the Confederation Council, but he didn't expect it to be. Rather than present the agreement directly to the body of leaders, Gino gathered his strongest supporters,
Bartos Rolek, Emilio Torres, Shannon Brixton, and, of course, Katrina Pascoe.
"You want to convince the Council to build warships?" Bartos asked in surprise, unable to let Gino finish his presentation.
"Add the Omnians, Herakans, and New Terrans together, Bartos. How many worlds do you have?" Gino asked rhetorically. "We can't expect them to protect the entire Confederation."
"Look how many probes have already been discovered," Katrina added. It was obvious to the small group whose side she favored.
"And what have we been doing about them, throwing rocks at them? Once we were the technological leaders of humankind in this small part of the galaxy, and we prided ourselves on that, but we aren't anymore."
"Sirs, how many times must danger visit our worlds before we decide to take up the defense of our systems in our own hands?" Gino asked, rising from his chair to address his friends. Unknowingly, he was imitating an approach often used by Alex and Omnian senior officers.
"But you aren't only asking us to build warships," Emilio said. "You're also asking us to provide military-trained personnel to crew them."
"Alex Racine has offered an idea for that," Gino argued. "We can train our personnel at the Herrick Naval Academy. What better place could there be?"
"I don't see Meridians volunteering for service," Shannon Brixton said.
"Perhaps, sir, that's because you don't view the Independents as Meridians," Katrina replied.
Gino's friends glanced from Katrina to him and back. Gino wore a grin and cocked an eyebrow.
"You'd force the Independents to serve in the military?" Emilio asked. He was incredulous, and then taken aback when Gino and Katrina burst into laughter.
"My friends, I love you dearly, but I must admit that sometimes I'm confused by your thinking," Gino said.
"It's our thinking that has remained consistent, Gino," Shannon accused. "You and Katrina have spent a great deal of time throughout the years with Alex and Renee."
"That's true, Shannon, but you know who else was in their company, in addition to New Terrans?"
"Meridians. Independents," Gino replied.
"They're Alex's fiercest supporters, and with the Sades, they're the leaders in the fight against the Nual."
"What's your point, Gino?" Shannon asked.
"It's this, Shannon. We won't force the military on the Independents. In fact, I'd like to suspend the process of branding our people as Independents. I believe the Meridians who display a displeasure with our societal strictures might be the individuals who would embrace naval service. And if they don't, we should find another means of keeping them within our society rather than shipping them off to some forsaken colony.
Especially since Alex Racine continues to liberate them and make them a valuable part of his worlds," Katrina interjected.
"If nothing else, that should prove the insanity of what we do, discarding our citizens for what we believe are errant behaviors, while another individual who has twice protected our worlds collects them for their value to his societies."
Quiet followed Katrina's words. This particular group of leaders hadn't been in favor of the harsh environment of Daylon, the dead moon that served as the last Independent colony. In contrast, many council leaders had been incensed at Alex's efforts to support the evacuation of the first colony at Libra, and more so when he liberated Daylon.
"Are you intent on tying all this together in your presentation to the council, Gino?" Bartos asked, dubious about the success of that possibility.
"How can we accomplish the goal of protecting the Confederation if we don't line up every element—the agreement's approval, warship construction, cease branding the Independents, raising a military force, and requesting training at Herakon?"
Gino's three friends looked from one to another, and the council leader shared a glance with his partner Katrina. When no one had much to say, Gino thanked them for coming and showed them to the door of his luxurious Sky Tower suite.
"That went well," Katrina joked. But when she noticed Gino's crestfallen expression, she hugged him.
"Apologies, Gino. That was insensitive of me."
"I'd hoped for a sign of support, at least from this group. In manner of thought, they're closest to us. If I can't convince them to see the way forward, how am I going to convince the Council, with the likes of Darce Lemoyne and Lawrence Teresi in attendance?"
Gino walked to the slate of windows that encompassed one entire side of the salon. Clouds had moved in far below the Sky Tower's uppermost level, where Gino's suite of rooms occupied the entire floor. The lights of the Meridian Capital were obscured. Katrina came up behind Gino and encircled his waist with her arms.
"I don't have an answer for you, my partner," she said.
Then she laughed, softly. Gino turned around within her grasp and pulled her to him, nuzzling her ear.
"Why do you laugh?"
Katrina chuckled and said,
"Of all things to think, I was wondering what Alex would do."
She could feel Gino's soft laughter through her chest, and she hugged him tighter. Then his laughter halted, and she pulled her head back to study his face. Gino was staring into space.
"Yes, what Alex would do," Gino repeated in a whisper.
Then he smiled, a huge, broad smile, and kissed Katrina's forehead. In an unprecedented move for a council leader, Gino Diamante waited for his guests in Confederation Hall's ornate and awe-inspiring main entrance corridor. Translucent panels along one side of the corridor splayed the light of Meridian's star in mesmerizing colors.
"Sirs, thank you for coming at short notice," Gino said by way of greeting the four sages who advanced quickly toward him.
"Generous of you to say, Council Leader Diamante," Domino replied. "But we serve the Confederation, and a request by your personage, as polite as it was couched, isn't something we would ignore."
Gino nodded in appreciation and asked, "Were you able to complete your tables and come to a conclusion?"
"For something as considerable as what you've asked, Leader Diamante," Serge replied. "We would have preferred considerably more time to research the data. However, we're prepared to offer the Council a preliminary summary."
"Excellent," Gino replied. "This way, Sirs."
Those seated in the Supplicants' Hall, which preceded Council Chambers, rose and nodded at Gino as he passed. The attendant at the Council's massive doors was shocked to see the Council Leader using this manner of entrance to the exalted chambers. He hurriedly signaled the doors aside, and his mouth was slightly ajar as Gino and his guests marched inside.
"To business, fellow leaders," Gino said as he ascended his centrally located podium, which allowed him to meet the rows of leaders at eye level. The four sages stood patiently beside the raised dais, waiting for their cues. Gino spent the best part of an hour outlining his plan, but his presentation wasn't without interruption. He decided to divulge his entire concept in one go, and as certain leaders heard various elements that they found incredible, they vocalized their objections. In the case of each interruption, Gino halted and waited while the council's controller called the leaders to order, indicating to them that the council leader held the floor and hadn't opened the meeting to discussion. When Gino finished and requested comments from the leaders, Darce Lemoyne jumped to his feet.
"This is a preposterous assembly of fiction, and to frighten us into tearing apart the fabric of Meridian society."
"Which part do you consider fictional, Leader Lemoyne?" Gino asked.
"The second sphere the Omnians have located? The probes that have been found in every human system and that we are still finding in nearby systems?
The Nual aren't a single event that we're fortunate to have survived with the aid of others. They're being considered an extensive and ancient civilization with an age-old habit of expanding their territory."
"The Confederation is wealthy," Lawrence Teresi called out. "Even if we were to require protection from these aliens, we have the credits to hire others who have a taste for killing."
"And how would you go about that, Leader Teresi?" Gino asked.
I have it on good authority from President Lachaud of Herrican, Envoy Gonzalez of New Terra, and Alex Racine of Omnia, that they will be constructing warships to protect their systems and hunt the Nual Sphere. After that, they intend to find the aliens' home world, or worlds, as it might be. Do you think they'll be eager to accept our credits so they might protect us, while they leave their own people vulnerable? At this point, I must admit I'm undecided about the Council Leader's proposal, Shannon Brixton said, standing to make her statement. But I must point out the fallacies in Leader Teresi's consideration that we might pay for protection. The governments enumerated by our Council Leader have responsibility for a total of 3 worlds. They haven't the time or resources, even if they had the will or desire, to provide the forces for the number of Confederation systems we presently occupy. And consider these additional 2 points. Are we to sit idle and cease expansion so that we don't strain a military shield if we could hire one? And how long would these employed forces be required to patrol our systems? It might be generations before the Nual come our way. Then, when the incursion finally came, Leader Teresi has every expectation that these hired individuals would happily expend their lives defending worlds that aren't inhabited by their people. Shannon's observations were scaring the leaders, who, for the most part, wanted no part of Gino's proposal. On the other hand, they disagreed with Darce Lemoyne that the threat wasn't real. I took the liberty of providing assistance to help you reach a decision on what I'm proposing, Gino said. All of you know the 4 Sages beside me, but you might not recognize them in their present guise since they were freed. Gino had used a word unwelcomed by the council leaders. They preferred to refer to the Sages as released, not freed. Gino's term, although accurate, connoted the distasteful image of imprisonment. May I introduce Domino, Serge, Linton, and Pierce, Gino said. The 4 Sages gave a leader's salutation to the council as they were introduced. Murmurs, whispers, and thoughts ran through the rows of leaders. The 4 Sages had never sailed a starship, managed a station or a sky tower, or run a house. The Confederation had installed these 4 Sages independent of any such tasks. They were created specifically to offer risk assessment to any leader regarding business proposals. Across the Confederation, there were few Sages respected more than these 4, except for Winston, the ex-council Sage, who now headed the Sage's Strategic Investment Fund, referred to as SIF. Compared to the flamboyant synth skins adopted by many of the Sages who had immigrated to Herrican and Omnia, these 4 Sages appeared normal, bland even. In most respects, they adopted common human characteristics, except for their avatar's stature, which was neither the slender Meridian nor the robust New Terran. Domino took a step forward. I have been asked to present our findings on the risk assessment of whether the Confederation should provide military protection for its colonies or not. We aren't commenting on how a force might be procured if the Council chooses that direction. Despite the complex nature of Council Leader Diamante's query, we examined the financial risks of this choice based on actuary data and standard risk management practices. Domino outlined what data the Sages had used to create their actuary tables. She enumerated the evidence collected about the Nual spheres and probes. Carefully and succinctly, she built toward her conclusion. In summary, leaders, it's evident that the threat is of such magnitude that it would be foolish not to provide some sort of insurance to mitigate a potential disaster, Domino said. My colleague is careful with her words, leaders, Linton said, stepping beside Domino. In simpler terms, we believe the Nual threat is severe enough that there is every possibility the Confederation could be wiped from its systems. Our advice is, spend your credits and protect yourselves and us. While I appreciate the service of these 4 individuals who have been of great value to all of us,
Lemoyne said. I might point out that these are conjectures, what-ifs, that we can't depend on to require us to make extensive changes in our society.
Leader Lemoyne, I must correct your statement, Pierce said. Your house